talking about today is work that was done in collaboration with Steve Simon, who's at Oxford, and his graduate student, Kurt von Keyserlingk, who incidentally will be finishing his doctorate next year and looking for postdocs. Just a little advertisement. He's very smart. So Phil Anderson famously said, you know, more is different. And today I'd like to take a rather liberal interpretation of the word more and ask, is three different? Okay. And in particular, actually, how is three different? So let me explain one way in which three is definitely different. So, you know, in two dimensions, there's this fact that you can have point particles that have anionic statistics, which is to say, if you exchange them, they need not be bosons or fermions. They can be something else. Okay. And I think it's fair to say that we understand how to classify these theories in two dimensions. We understand what they are. There's a notion of topological order. And, you know, we have a variety of models that show us sort of how to realize this, even in lattice systems. Now, one way in which three dimensions is different is that, you know, in 3D, it's mathematically impossible to have point-like particles that are anionic. Okay, they have to be either bosons or fermions. So what I'm going to talk about today is very much related to what Zheng Han talked about yesterday. And yet we know in three dimensions that we have these sort of cousins of some of these two-dimensional anion models. Okay. Now, these cousins are a little bit different. They have actually, in the cases that I'm going to talk about, they have a trivial bulk, but they can realize sort of topologically ordered anion states at the surface. And they have these very sort of complicated ground states that are really related to the anion theories from which they're built. So the question that I'd like to ask about, you know, how is three different from two is really, you know, when are these really phases of matter? Okay. And as I said, in two dimensions, we really understand, I think, how to answer that question. We understand how to classify phases using topological order. There's also a notion of symmetry protection in 2D, which isn't really going to touch on what I'm talking about at all. So the first observation, and I think this will become a little clearer later in my talk, is that in three dimensions, the notion of topological order certainly is not enough for us to say that, you know, all of these models that Zheng Han knows how to build are distinct phases. So topological order tells us something about certain kinds of theories with point-like particles called discrete gauge theories. And obviously, as we heard a lot earlier today, the notion of symmetry protection, which Xia is going to talk about in her talk with relation to these models, can sometimes tell us that these are, you know, distinct phases of matter. There's something special happening at the surface. And so I guess in this talk, I'm sorry to say I'm not going to give an answer, but I'd like to sort of ask a question, which is there something else? Are there reasons to believe that there might be something else? Okay. So I'm going to start by telling you about some models. And so Zheng Han, in his talk, gave a very general formulation for how to write down three-dimensional models based on an anion theory that have these interesting surface states. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just focus on the very simplest example, and we're going to talk about the models and their excitations, and then at the end I'm going to tell you a little bit about their phase diagram and what's sort of unusual about that. So the starting point is going to be, let's think a little bit about these two-dimensional models. So a family of two-dimensional models that realize interesting anion physics on the lattice were introduced by Levin and Wendt, and the name of the game is as follows. So I have a lattice, I have a spin system on each edge with, say, p different spins, and I'm just going to write down a Hamiltonian, and it's going to be of this general form. It has a vertex term and a plaquette term, and the name of the game is that I have to choose these terms such that they commute, okay? And I want to do that so that I can solve the Hamiltonian. If I can solve the Hamiltonian, I can understand its ground state degeneracy and the statistics of its excitations, okay? So the simplest possible example that we can have of this is the following. So the simplest thing that I could choose is to have just an Ising spin on each edge. So I have two spin states. And the simplest choice of this vertex term that I could write down is something that energetically penalizes any configurations in which there are an odd number of spin downs at each vertex. Okay, so I'm going to color the spin downs bright green, or here they're bright red, because that's bad. And what we find is that there are two possible choices that I can have for this plaquette term. Okay, so the first observation is, you know, this condition that I should have an even number of spin downs, this is compatible with any operator that just flips spins along some sort of closed loop, for example, around a plaquette. Okay? So the first plaquette term that I can write down, the simplest thing I could do, is just flip all the spins on the plaquette, and many of you will recognize this as the Hamiltonian for the familiar toric code. Okay? Now I have another choice. So you might think that actually I could do something like flip all the spins and multiply by any phase that I wanted, actually, that just, for example, cared about the spin variables on these other edges near the plaquette or something like that. So it turns out that the condition that the plaquette operators themselves have to commute restricts the choices, but there is one other choice, and it basically looks like this. Okay, so we're going to flip all of the spins around the edges of the plaquette, and on these red edges here, we're also going to measure sigma z, and we're going to assign a phase. Okay, and this phase is actually, in fact, because this number of spins has to be even, this phase is always plus or minus 1. Okay. So this is the simplest example because the ground states are kind of easy to draw. And they're easy to draw because the vertex condition means that you can think of them as sort of a gas of closed loops. Okay. And the only difference between these two models, and this is basically what Cenk was saying in his talk in different terms. I mean, so you have these two models, and the only difference is that when you have these closed loops, which in his case were like domain walls, okay, in one case, so all configurations of closed loops appear in the ground state, okay? In the toric code case, the relative coefficient of all of them will be plus 1. And in this other case, I'm going to call this the semion model, some of these configurations will appear with a minus sign. In particular, the configurations with an odd number of these loops will appear with a minus sign. Okay. So, good. So now I'm going to just very briefly tell you a little bit about the excitations in these models. So there are two, basically I have a vertex term and a plaquette term, and so I can make excitations by violating the vertex term or violating the plaquette term. Okay. And if I want to violate the plaquette term, I mean, actually both of these operators just flip spins around a plaquette. So in either case, I can use the same operator and I can just measure sigma z, let's do it right now, okay, on an edge. And that creates a pair of plaquette defects, okay, on the two neighboring plaquettes. And now you notice, okay, and that's because, sigma x and sigma z don't commute, but actually two sigma x's and two sigma z's do commute. So if I do this again, say on this edge over here, that's going to fix the problem on this plaquette. Okay, there's no excitation there anymore. And move it over here so you can see that I can make these vortex excitations. I can pull them apart just sort of by acting on this string of edges. Okay. So the other term I had was the vertex term. So let's call some violations of that. So in this toric code example, I can just act with sigma x on an edge. So that will create violations just because that's going to flip the spins and change the eigenvalue of this operator. Okay, so here we go. And in the toric code, conveniently, this operator commutes with the plaquette term. So again, I can move these apart by acting on adjacent edges. Okay, and these are what you would think of in the toric code as sort of deconfined charge-like excitations. Okay. So here's the interesting thing about the semion model. So if we just try and act with this operator sigma x, okay, again, I flip a pair of spins, and that creates a pair of vertex defects. But you notice that actually, on this plaquette here and this plaquette here, these phases actually care. Okay, they care about the spin eigenvalue on this edge. Okay, so if I do this, I create not only vertex defects but plaquette defects. Well, okay, so let's see what happens when we try and move these apart. So I can act on this edge here, again, just with sigma x. And actually, not only do I not fix the problem on this plaquette, but I actually create more trouble for myself. Okay, and you can keep doing this. And what you find is that as you try and pull these two sort of candidate charge defects apart, you create like this line of plaquette defects. Okay, so this excitation is confined. And the moral of this story in two dimensions is this is the wrong operator. Okay, this is not kind of an operator that I really want to think about. So the operator that I really want to think about is an operator that creates sort of deconfined charges. And basically, so the interesting thing about two dimensions is that even with these phases in the plaquette term, it is possible to define an operator which does a combination of sort of flipping spins and measuring phases, okay, which commutes with the plaquette terms kind of along the length of the string. Okay, so So here we go. So I flip a spin, okay? I create some problems. And then basically what I'm going to do, so there are factors of plus or minus one that actually care, you know, about the spin states before I flip along this edge. And then I have to assign these phase factors of I, actually depending on these little edges that are going to be colored red, along the, so this is sort of the sigma x, and this is the edges where I'm measuring this number, okay? And you do this, and so I haven't been very careful at the endpoints. So we might have some problems left over at the endpoints here. But you can convince yourself, if you write this down, that kind of along the length of the string, you can pull these arbitrarily far apart at finite energy cost. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, so as I showed in the previous slide, I had no choice but to put in these extra phase factors. Otherwise, the object that I was making was confined. And basically, so these extra phase factors also tell me that when I move these objects past each other, they have non-trivial mutual statistics. Okay. And in fact, they have semionic statistics. Now, it turns out, in this model, there are actually two consistent choices that I can make for the phase factor. So let me actually, all right, here we go, makes them anions. So I actually come to my sort of summary slide. So there are two choices of phase, and this means there are two kinds of anions, okay? And what this model actually, you know, sort of physically resembles is it's a little bit like you took two copies of a bosonic Laughlin state with oppositely oriented oriented magnetic fields, okay, and you have these two species of semion with opposite chirality living in the top and bottom layer, okay. And the other model that I told you about was the toric code, so we've heard a lot about that. It has deconfined bosonic charges, and it has deconfined fluxes, okay, and they have this mutual Berry phase. Good. All right. So now I'm going to talk about the same game as in 3D, and the models I'm going to talk about are the models that Zheng Han introduced with Kevin Walker, but I'm going to talk about them in a slightly more kind of concrete language, so hopefully it won't be too much redundant with his talk. So basically, let's try and do the same thing in 3D. So the name of the game, again, is I want to write down a Hamiltonian that has a vertex term and a Plaquette term, and we want to pick these such that they commute. And in that way, the model will be solvable, and I'll be able to tell you about its ground states and its excitations. Now, there is this technical point, and Zheng Han mentioned it in his talk, that you know, really we like to think about the cubic lattice, like the only one I can draw on, certainly the only one I can draw on PowerPoint. So like I did not make this figure, actually. I stole it from Kurt. But for technical reasons, there are cases where it's much simpler to actually think about pulling these vertices apart, okay, into trivalent vertices. And I just want to sort of draw a picture. You know, so if you think about this semion model, you have these little strings. And in the toric code, I could think about a vertex with sort of four lines coming in. And when I draw such a vertex, I can't tell you actually whether, if I thought of these as sort of lines in three dimensions, whether they did something like this. Okay, one crossed over the other. Maybe they avoided each other. And in the toric code, that doesn't matter, but actually in the semion model, it does. Okay, so that's basically the reason that you draw this picture. Morally speaking, you know, we like to think about the square lattice, that's more or less okay, but there can be this technicality. If you actually try and compute something with the model I'm talking about, you should use this. Okay, good. All right, so general picture, Hamiltonians. So now let's come back and talk about like the simplest possible examples that we can have in three dimensions. Okay. So again, here's our favorite vertex condition. It's going to be exactly the same. I have, again, a spin up and a spin down on each link. And the vertices that can appear in the ground state are going to be the ones where the number of spin downs on each link is even. Okay. And now the Plaquette term for the toric code is exactly the same as in two dimensions, right? Which is to say, you know, obviously, if I just flip all the spins on this Plaquette, that's going to commute with this vertex term. Bored on the airplane, so I made a little animation of this for you guys. Okay, there you go. Good times. Okay, so that's one Plaquette term. It's exactly like in 2D. So then let's ask, well, what about the second, you know, kind of Plaquette term that I could write down in 2D? Does that have an analog in 3D? So let me remind you. So you know, the kind of the obvious, in some sense, generalization of the 2D Plaquette term would be to just try and do the same thing on a 3D Plaquette, right? So I had this operator that flipped the spins along the green edges and that assigned some phase by, you know, based on the spin eigenvalue on these red edges, the sort of legs coming out of the Plaquette. So this is what you might expect if you just tried to take your 2D model and put it in 3D. But it turns out that when you do this, when you do this, these Plaquette terms don't commute. Okay, so you can write down such a model, but it's not exactly solvable, which is too hard for us. So, but happily, one can fix this. Okay, so this was sort of the Hamiltonian that Zenghan was talking about yesterday for this particular model. Looks like this. You can fix this by adding one small extra phase. Okay, so. And what this phase does is it assigns, you know, plus or minus I depending on the difference in spins on this edge here and this edge here. Okay, and really what that's telling you is, you know, there are some factors of plus or minus one, but up to those, it cares about whether the spin on this edge that sticks into the plaquette is up or down. Okay, so that's how we sort of pick these.
Jana?
Yo.
Did you really pack the commute?
Yeah, they do commute. Yeah, you can... Yeah.
I have no confidence in the problem.
Well, okay, so in this case, Kurt checked and we checked his calculation that they do explicitly commute. Yeah, he did all the hard work.
I wonder whether, but, you know, one can add a framing to this loop.
To the semion.
And one only, in one formulation, these down spins is only for the leg which is crossed by the framing. I wonder, that works for the fermion case. I wonder whether it works for the semion case.
It does. That's the general case.
Yeah. So the one way to, you add a parallel loop around this loop.
Oh, sorry, a parallel loop around the plaquette.
You have this bold line.
Yeah.
Then you add you shift this bold line
as
a framing. Then you only count the down spin on the leg which crossed by the framing.
Yes. Yeah. That's I think. I mean, the pictures that you guys have in your paper are exactly that.
Yeah.
The top one. Yeah. If you look at the end point of the first red and the beginning of the second red, that's the two. You don't think about that. The projection is also the back square. That's the frame you give you.
Wouldn't it be more natural to define these things in fermion for fermions, where your elementary cannot be the freedom of fermionic, or that doesn't work?
Well, okay. So. So his question is: would it be simpler to build a model from, you know, elementary degrees of freedom? So instead of spins on the edge, you want to take fermions on the edge.
You can, but it's very complicated.
Well, I would guess that actually the semion model is like the same as a toric code, but instead of spin one half, well, you take something like fermions, and it would feel like we get.
All right. So thanks for the discussion. And maybe just to kind of for people who are less familiar with the technical details, let me just kind of give you a picture. Let me just say the main difference, you know, between the 3D and the 2D. Model is the fact that you can get these complex phases. So actually, you can get factors of plus or minus I in the wave function. Okay, and what these factors do is the following thing. You can draw. So this is a configuration. The black represents spin down. Okay, now we're going to act on this plaquette with the plaquette term. So we're going to flip all of these spins. And what does that do? Well, I'm looking at this picture from a particular angle, and that angle is actually important to defining the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is your question about framing, and when I flip all these spins, I get this twist, okay? And it's the fact that I see this world line twist that is responsible for the factor of I. So this is, I think, essentially that you should think of this as having a framing built in. Good, and here's what the ground states look like. So, you know, in the toric code, it really does look like you've just taken the 2D model and you know, it's very much the same thing. In three dimensions, you just have a superposition of over all the closed loops that I can draw. That's my ground state. And the relative coefficient between these is always one. Okay. Now, in the semion model, you know, like in 2D, I mean, the magnitude of the coefficients here are always the same as in the toric code. Okay, so you have all of these loops. And there's a subtlety here that I'll come back to in a minute. All of these loops appear, but their relative coefficients can be plus or minus one or plus or minus I. Okay. And And the interesting thing about this is an interesting relationship to the anion model that underlies this, right? So semions are kind of defined by this fact that if you exchange them, you get a phase factor of I. Now, if you wanted to think about, for example, this loop as representing a world line of semions, right? So it's sort of a 3D world line of these 2D particles. This factor of I is exactly like, you know, I created a pair of semions, I exchanged them, and I re-annihilated them, okay? So really the loops in the ground state look like, these coefficients, you know, look like they are world lines of sort of anions in a theory of a dimension lower.
Yeah. Maybe you already explained this, but the rules for determining the phase factors are what for the semion?
Right. Yeah. So basically, that's right. So you hand me a configuration of loops, and you say, Fiona, is this going to be plus one, minus one,
exactly,
plus I or minus I? Okay.
Yeah,
right. Right. So and I should say, well, Sentel, what you have is like a bunch of world lines of semions. So you can take your Laughlin state, okay. And you can actually, you know, do these exchange processes that would correspond to these world line trajectories, and that will give you a phase of plus one minus one or plus or minus I, and that will tell you the coefficient of this particular configuration of loops in the ground state. Okay.
So does it depend on which direction I call the time direction? Or?
Yeah. Okay. So that's the thing. So. This, yeah, okay. So it is perhaps best to think of that only in theories where you don't have to worry too much about like getting extra signs when you turn things down in time. I mean, this is space, okay?
Yeah, I know there's space, but in the world length picture, some direction has to be chosen as time.
Has to be chosen as time. Yeah, so that's right. So
and when you make different choices, it's like doing a modular transformation.
When you make different charges, it's like doing modular. Yeah. Although, is that relevant to the question, to Sentel's question?
But what you get is like the partition function of the 2D series, which is not the environment in the modular transformation chain by some state.
So maybe in view of time, we will discuss it at the end.
Sure.
I could ask you a very quick question.
Yeah.
So suppose you just take any some generic model with its world lines and something.
Yeah.
So is it important to have a lattice construction behind it, or can just do everything by picture like this, where you have a bunch of loops with of various anions and the corresponding phases?
So what I would say is, I mean, it's not personally important to me to have a lattice construction. and what I mean by that is, you know, I mean, you could do what Chenkei was doing. You know, you could start with like a nonlinear sigma model, and you could say I have these ground states that have domains, and those domains appear with a relative phase of plus or minus one. Okay, you could do what Matthew was doing, and you could condense the dions, and you could write down a field theory, you know, and maybe an appropriate field theory, you know, you could think about getting the same phase.
Forward. Can you put up the lattice construction for every choice of anion?
So basically, if you give a well-defined, so that's the nice thing about these models. They're very general, okay? I'll sort of come back to that point later, that they're very general. If you give me an anion model, you know, you can.
Does it have to be non-chiral?
Does it have to be non-chiral? No. No, it does not. Yeah. So, good. Okay.
I have a question. So is that last picture there at the end, is that somehow like in contradiction to that usual story people say about in 3D you can't have anions? I mean, I see like an eye and I see a...
No. So let me come back to that question in a minute. So I'm going to answer that. Yeah. So you might worry, you know, I mean... But the key point is I'm saying this is actually some configuration that appears in my ground state, and I'm saying I can understand the coefficient by imagining that it's a world line of a 2 plus 1d particle. Okay, so we'll come back to the excitations in a minute. Now,
can I follow John's question? It can just be non-chiral. It's not necessarily non-chiral. Can you give a chiral example?
Cairo.
What's
I mean, by chiral you would mean like it has a chiral edge mode in 2D. Yeah. So right. So actually, let me answer that question in like one slide. Okay. We'll talk about the surface in a second and maybe that'll become more apparent. So let me say a couple things about excitation. So just like in 2D, we want to know we know what the ground state is. We want to know what the excitations are. So again, there's two kinds of excitations. I can make Plaquette excitations. I can make vertex excitations. Okay. And again, okay, and remember this. It'll be important at the end of the talk. Again, so in these two models for the Plaquette excitations, it's the same operator. Okay. So what I do is I measure the spin on some edge, and this sigma z that I'm using here fails to commute with sigma x on all of the four Plaquettes touching that edge. Okay. So I make a little ring of Plaquette defects. Now this time. So let's act with sigma z again. Okay, so I can act with sigma z over here. That fixes this Plaquette in the middle. Okay, but I create more defects out here. So you keep going. Okay, and what you see is that as you might expect, in fact, these vortices in 3D form vortex loops. Okay, so so the Plaquette defects form these closed vortex loops. Good. So what about the vertex excitations? As you might expect in the toric code, I just act with sigma x along some bunches of edges. And exactly like in 2D, I can make these charges. I can pull them apart. There's no problem. So what about in this second example, in the semion model? So now remember, in the semion model, even in 2D, okay, I had to write down a more complicated sort of charge creation operator, right? I had to add these extra phases that sort of measured some spins on some of the links adjacent to this trajectory in order to have something that didn't, that wasn't already confined. Now, in 3D, it turns out that you can't do that. Okay? So there's no operator that you can write down that will flip, a bunch of spins and not make any Plaquette defects. Okay? So the best that you can do is basically choose. So here are my two vertices, V1 and V2. Okay, I'm going to choose a line of Plaquettes that I'm going to put the vortices on. And the best that I can do is make a pair of charges separated by this kind of tube of vortices. Okay, and I can do that with a judicious choice of these factors of plus or minus 1 and plus or minus I. Okay. Maybe I'll just say for the experts in the audience, this is sort of, you can think of, putting your string operator, you're threading your string operator through these Plaquettes. That's how you choose the phases. Okay, So if we look at this picture, we notice that, so I have chosen the line of violated Plaquettes to be here, like above the plane of this string operator. So actually you shouldn't be surprised to learn that when I come to the surface, okay, I do have deconfined excitations, right? Because I can choose the layer of Plaquettes that had violations to be just outside the system. So that doesn't cost any energy. And then there is, so unlike in 2D where there were two choices, at the surface of the 3D model, there's one choice of sort of convention for these phases such that I can separate these charges apart on the surface. They're deconfined on the surface. So maybe to come back to the question about chirality that you guys were interested in. So what this means is that, on the surface of this, I think it's in my next slide. Yeah. So in the 2D system, remember we had sort of a 2D system that was like having two layers of the quantum Hall system with opposite fields. Okay. In 3D, it's a little bit like I have taken those two layers. So these are chiral quantum Hall theories, right? This is a bosonic, nu equals a half, Laughlin state, has a chiral edge mode. It's like I've taken these two copies and I've pulled them apart. So one is at the top boundary. Okay? So the semion sits up here, the anti-semion sits down here. Okay, and in the bulk, I have no deconfined excitations. Okay, I have vortex loops and I have confined charges. Okay, now you can contrast this with what happens in the Z2 gauge theory, the toric code, where you have these vortex loops and you have these deconfined charges. Okay, And one of the things, and you can actually see this directly in the ground states, okay, if you examine the ground states of this model. But so one of the things that sort of physically you shouldn't be surprised by when I tell you there's no deconfined charge in the bulk is that this system is not topologically ordered. So if you put it in periodic boundary conditions and take away the surface, there is no ground state degeneracy. Okay, so the bulk is kind of trivial.
Excuse me, there's a question. So the model is a dual vertex term and a plaquette term in Hamiltonian with commute. Usually when you multiply this plaquette term together, making a big disk, the boundary will be like a string operator which gave you a charge. So somehow in 3D, this construction does not work. You need 2D, that's one way to work. You many plaquette operator together, you cover a disk, then that's how you construct a string operator on the boundary.
On the boundary?
On the boundary of the disk. You have many plaquette operator multiplied together in the region.
Yeah, and you make a closed...
And cancel, the only boundary survive, and that's your string operator.
Yes.
But however, in three dimension, this construction fails.
Yeah. So that's right. And this is sort of. So basically, I don't really know how to think about this. But like that closed. You know, you can make a closed string operator by acting with a bunch of plaquette projectors. But that object, you can't cut it open.
I see.
And I don't know how to. I mean, I think there's probably a field theoretic kind of way to think about it, but I don't know what it is. Yeah. Maybe Zhenghan has some thoughts.
I think it's just a matter of the way we're linking out the edges, so that loop won't create. It's not this compound.
Good. So let me just to sort of orient what I've been saying, which has been focusing on these very simple examples in the context of what Zhenghan was saying. So, you know. The point is that this is actually a very general construction. Okay, so in Zhenghan's talk, he basically said, you know, it's supposed to be anions, not ions. But if you give me an anion theory with, say, you know, p species of anions, and that anion theory, you know, has to come with some information about what we call fusion and what we call braiding. Okay, so fusion basically is going to tell me in my lattice model what the allowed vertices are, and it's also going to tell me something about how I have to flip these spins. And braiding is basically going to tell me, you know, when I have these pictures that appear in my ground state, these loops with twists in them, what phase is associated with that, okay? So I can take these rules from my anion theory, write down a Hamiltonian, okay? And I just want to emphasize this is very general. You can give you can give me your favorite bosonic quantum Hall state. We could talk about Majorana fermions, by which I mean like the Ising conformal field theory. Okay, if that's not exotic enough for you, you could do like Fibonacci anions, okay? This is really not restricted to the very simple models that I was talking about, okay? And in all of these cases, you know, you can have these surfaces that have these deconfined chiral anions.
Not okay?
Yes, that's right. It is not doubled, but it's a little like a topological insulator. You know, you took your fermion doubling and you put one Dirac cone up here and one Dirac cone down here. Okay, it's a lot like that you have your doubled quantum Hall and one on the top and one on the bottom.
You know, starting from which anion model you get a topological order phase, and on which anion model you get a no degeneracy in 3D.
Yeah. So that yes, and actually, I mean, Zhenghan mentioned this yesterday. That okay. So you have your anion theory, and one of the things that you can say about your anion theory, you can ask, is it modular? And that means, is there a particle? So if there's a particle that braids trivially with everyone, it's not modular. Okay. If the anion model is modular, then the bulk is completely confined. Okay. If it's not modular, there will be deconfined charges in the bulk, and the things that are deconfined are precisely the things that braid trivially with everybody. Okay. Good. So that's also general. And the ground states, you know, always have this form that they're sort of a soup of loops, or more generally soup of what Michael and Chagan called string nets, whose coefficients are related to sort of thinking of these as 2+1 dimensional world lines of the anions. Yeah.
I'm sorry to bother you about this again, but so the kind of chirality that you found where the chiral lobes are separated on the top and the bottom is not the kind I was asking about.
Okay, sorry.
So you wrote this wave function, which was the sum of loop configurations.
Yeah.
You told us in your dialogue with Semple that to compute the coefficient of one of those terms, you braid the anions. What if the anion theory that you're using is itself not double?
It's not.
But here, I mean, you're using this thing which was new, which was the half and minus half.
Right. Okay. So the anion theory.
You're not reiterating this.
Oh. Okay. So yeah, maybe I should keep. Maybe we should come back to that question, or maybe we can talk about it afterwards. But basically, the ingredients of the model of this thing are, you know, you have some anion model that you use to write down the Hamiltonian in a way that I haven't been very precise about. But that anion model is chiral. So for the model that I talked about, the underlying anion model is one copy of the semion model, not two. Yeah. Good. So all right. So right. And I want to emphasize, you know, you can write down these ground states, and the bulk, you know, if I have a modular theory, the bulk is trivial, but the ground states are very complicated. Okay. So if this, you know, these are like highly non-trivial ground states. Okay. So that's it's true. Okay. So let me now. I want to explain something kind of weird that can happen in these highly non-trivial ground states. Okay. So let's talk about the phase diagram of this model. So again, let me come back to the simplest example that we know, which is the toric code. Okay. Two kinds of perturbations I can add to the toric code. So you know, we have vortex defects, we have charge defects. I could condense either one of them. So I can condense vortex defects by adding this term sigma z on an edge. Okay, what does this do? This penalizes edges that have spin down, meaning that if I make it big, I'm going to get to a phase where all the loops have to be short, right? If I make it big compared to the other terms of the Hamiltonian. The other thing I can do is proliferate charges by acting with this sigma x operator. Okay, and so this was worked out quite a long time ago, and this phase diagram, you know, looks like this. So you have these two perturbations. You start with the toric code. If you make gamma z very large, you proliferate vortices. You go into this short loop phase via something that's called a confining transition. If you make gamma x large, you go through what's called the Higgs transition. Okay, and so that's the toric code that's been understood for a long time. Now, what about the semion model? So in the semion model, and this is kind of the thing that makes us able to say, you know, something at this point, is that, you know, in the semion model, actually, this operator in both 2D and 3D, this operator that makes these vortex loops or vortex excitations is exactly the same as in the toric code, okay? The charge operator behaves differently, right? So this perturbation would create some combination of plaquette and charge defects. So this transition is a little harder to think about, but so for right now, we're just going to focus on this kind of transition here. Okay, so I don't have very much time left, so let me just draw you some phase diagrams. So this would be the Higgs direction. I'm not going to talk about that today. But this along here is what in the toric code was the confining direction. Okay, and the key point is just this. Okay, look, so the operator that I write down to make vortices in the semion model is exactly the same. It does the same thing. It penalizes long loops. Okay, so if I make this perturbation large, I'm going to get from this region, the semion region, that has these long loops, to some region that has only short loops. And further, if I have this gamma x set to zero, so I'm right along this axis here, you can show that the phase transition is exactly the same, okay, in the gauge theory, where there had to be a phase transition because we know the model is topologically ordered, and in the semion model. Okay. So that's all very well. Okay, so you know, so there's a phase transition. It's a first order phase transition, so it has to persist, you know, to some finite value of gamma x. And we don't know, you know, maybe I can go around this way without a transition. I don't know the answer to that. So here's the weird thing that I'd like to tell you about before I end. Okay, let's think about some other models. Okay, so you know, I can, as I said, these models are quite general. And let's in particular think about a slightly more complicated incarnation of this called ZP gauge theory and its cousin, okay, in these phases with a confined bulk. So ZP gauge theory is very much like the toric code. You just have p spins on each edge instead of two. You have, again, deconfined charges and vortex loops, and they have some interesting mutual statistics. And its cousin in these Walker-Wang models is basically something that has that has Hall states. And I'll think about sort of bosonic Hall states. So we're going to think about this being nu equals a quarter on the top and nu equals minus a quarter on the bottom. And the bulk will be completely confined. There's no topological order. Okay, so here's my example. I'm going to focus on Z4. It has three different, I mean, it has spin 0, 1, 2, 3, okay? And the important thing about this model, okay, here's some pictures of the vertex terms. The important thing is, okay, there's two different perturbations that I can add on that proliferate vortices, okay? Basically, I can add a perturbation that, if you like, creates, you know, when you go through this transition, you proliferate all of the different types of vortices, okay? And that perturbation is something that simply penalizes any edge energetically that is in, that has a spin that's not zero, okay? And the second perturbation I can add is something that actually energetically penalizes only edges that have odd spins, okay? So that's fine, okay? And you can think about this as sort of condensing the sort of the spin 2 vortex, if you will. Okay. Sorry, that's maybe not a good way to say it. So anyway, sorry, so let me say one thing. So basically, again, these two perturbations, you know, to make these kinds of vortices are the same in the doubled semion model and in the, sorry, in the Walker-Wang model and in the ZP gauge theory, okay? And again, you can make this exact mapping between the phase transitions as long as you don't have any of these sort of charge type defects, okay? So you know, again, okay, here's the completely confining direction. I go along here. This was my Walker-Wang, you know, state that had this highly non-trivial trivial ground state. Here we go. You can go through this. You can go to this short loop phase. Okay, there's some kind of first order phase transition here, a confining transition. Okay, and here's, and I'll end on this note. Here's the weird thing. If you go up in this direction, okay, so now I condense some species of vortex, but I don't kill, you know, all of these loops. So I still have long loops of spin 2. And I go through this transition, it's a phase transition, and I find that condensing something out of this ground state, so I get rid of some of the spin degrees of freedom, and I end up in a state that has topological order, okay? The topological order, in fact, of the toric code, except the charge is fermionic, okay? So you can do this more generally, but I won't talk about that because I'm out of time. And so here's a sort of just summary, and maybe I just want to emphasize that, you know, I think this fact about the phase diagram, you know, really suggests that we should be thinking, we should be asking the question, you know, is there some sense in which these are distinct phases of matter? And are there cases where these surface states are protected? And that will, I think, be addressed to some degree in the next talk. Okay.